Hi, folks. This is Grant Padalko, an editor at RFERL.org, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. By the way, I just found out that 2011 is the 30th anniversary of the release of our theme song, REM's seminal first single, Radio Free Europe. And just like RFE, REM is still going strong with a new album coming out next week, so congratulations to them. But I digress. Let me tell you what's on the podcast this week. In our Meet the Blogger segment, we talk to Gulnaz Esfandiari, the author of our Persian Letters blog, which offers a window into Iranian politics and society by monitoring Iran's own active blogosphere.
In Iran, you don't have platforms where people can express themselves freely. And these blogs are actually a platform for Iranians, for young people, old people, where they talk about what they think, what they want.
In Uncovered, in which we share significant stories reported by our local bureaus that are getting scant attention in the Western press, a Belarusian presidential candidate shares his horrific experiences in a KGB prison earlier this year.
He compared the jail, the KGB pretrial detention center in Minsk, to a concentration camp and said that he was kept there naked on the freezing cold. He was handcuffed and dragged on the floor. He was beaten.
And we reveal the surprising role a group of Serbian pro-democracy activists played in the recent revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia.
We are simply trying to convince the world that the only right way to make a change is to fight strategically and in a non-violent way.
But first, a look at the personal side of politics. The relationship between father and son is considered one of the most complex human relationships, all the more so if the father is Belarusian strongman Alexander Lukashenko, and the son is a six-year-old boy who accompanies him virtually everywhere. Correspondent Daisy Sindelar explores the unusual childhood of Kolya Lukashenko.
He's had an audience with the Pope, inspected the military, and flashed his gold-plated pistol to the president of Russia. Mikolai Lukashenko, or Kolya as he's better known, is not your average six-year-old. But perhaps that's to be expected when your father is not the average citizen. He's Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, or Europe's last dictator, as he's better known. Lukashenko teases a round of applause from supporters as he credits Kolya for urging him to vote for himself for the first time in his career during presidential elections last December. But the blonde-headed Kolya does more than accompany his father to the voting booth. He plays sidekick on an entire range of presidential activities, everything from visiting poultry farms to sitting in on bilateral talks, sometimes atop his father's knee. It's a scenario that has made some Lukashenko loyalists uneasy. They say the constant presence of a six-year-old, even one as well-mannered as Kolya appears to be, does little to promote Belarusian politics as serious business. But observers say the Belarusian leader is unlikely to bow to such concerns. Lukashenko has two grown sons with his now estranged wife. But it is Kolya, who was born out of wedlock and whose mother is believed to be Lukashenko's former doctor, who has given the 56-year-old president what analyst Vladimir Padhol calls the first truly loving relationship of his life.
Lukashenko is very lonely. Completely, utterly lonely. He's distanced himself from everyone because he's afraid of everyone. He doesn't trust anyone. Even his older sons he sees as rivals who could be planning his removal from power. Kolya is the only person he can trust because he's small and doesn't present any kind of threat.
Kolya and his father do appear to have an affectionate father-son relationship. They are frequently shown hugging or holding hands, and Lukashenko has referred to his son as his tail, saying Kolya refuses to sleep or eat unless his father is nearby. Kolya has become a staple of Belarusian newscasts as he accompanies his father on his rounds. Such videos offer a rare glimpse into the privileges of life as the first son. On one outing, for example, Kolya is shown clutching a gleaming new iPhone and surrounded by bodyguards. But he is rarely shown with other children, engaging in rambunctious play or even smiling. Alexandra Dinko is a Belarusian journalist who focuses on child welfare issues. She says the televised displays of familial companionship say less about Kolya and more about Lukashenko, who has long nurtured an image as batska, or father, to the Belarusian nation.
A man with a small child seems big and strong. And as a father, Lukashenko looks sweet and commands respect. The president himself has often used his little boy to show his human side. This is a way for the president to present himself simply and clearly to society. But all the same, no one is really paying attention to the child himself. The public doesn't have any definitive opinion about him.
What much of the public does have an opinion on is the vicious nature of Lukashenko's crackdown following the December elections, when he threw hundreds of opponents in jail, including most of his presidential rivals. His wrath even extended to children, with the government threatening to seize the 3-year-old son of a jailed candidate. Child welfare advocates eventually intervened, but the threat sent shivers through the Belarusian opposition community as it became clear that Lukashenko's love for his own child was not going to soften his stance on others. Having already managed to hold on to the presidential post for 16 years, Lukashenko is considered unlikely to give up the top spot without a fight. He has even suggested that he is grooming Kolya as his successor, a scenario that would necessarily keep him in place for decades to come. But few in Belarus appear to be taking the idea of a President Kolya seriously. As this popular song suggests, it's not Kolya, but Sanya, a nickname for Alexander, who's intent on leading Belarus for as long as he can.
Мама просила, останься с нами. Папа просил, останься с нами. Ребята просили, останься с нами. Саня останется с нами. Саня останется с нами. Останется с нами. Все будет окей.
Говорить Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуш میکنید.
Машал Радіо Дамілі
Азатун ДТМ.
Радіо Азатун. 28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Radio Free Europe has 20 local bureaus scattered across our vast broadcast region from Sarajevo to Bishkek, Moscow to Baghdad, and in a segment we call Uncovered, we take a look at some of the best original reporting coming out of our bureaus, significant stories that aren't getting the coverage they deserve in the Western media. I'm joined here in the studio in Prague by Merhat Sharp-Jean and Pete Baumgartner, the editors of our From Our Bureaus page on rferl.org. Welcome to the Blender.
Thank you.
The first story, Merhat, I want to direct to you, is a story about a Belarusian presidential candidate who talked about his experiences in a KGB jail in Belarus.
Yes, it's a former Belarusian opposition presidential candidate, Aleš Mikhailovič. He made a very startling statement on Monday, February 28th, saying that, first of all, he compared the jail, the KGB pretrial detention center in Minsk, to a concentration camp, and said that he was kept there naked on the freezing cold. He was handcuffed and dragged on the floor. He was beaten. And he was put in an overcrowded cell and interrogated without a lawyer. And this, of course, wouldn't surprise anyone who grew up in the former Soviet Union. Those stories were usual at that time. And what surprises us now is that this thing still is happening in Belarus today. We can listen to him. We just interviewed him himself, and Mikhailovič said the following to us.
Some people wearing camouflage uniforms and face masks with no insignia dragged me out of my prison cell, handcuffed me behind my back, and pulled my arms so high my face was hitting the concrete floor. They took me down a spiral staircase into a separate room and started pulling my arms up so high that my bones cracked, demanding that I promise to do whatever I was told to do by state security officers. And they kept pulling my arms up until I said yes.
He says he was forced to sign a statement that he had collaborated
with KGB.
With the KGB.
Yes, and that's why he made this press conference openly tearing the copy of this agreement, saying that that was the only way for him to get released.
And the full interview, a video, I believe, of the interview is on our website. So, Pete, let me turn to you. An interesting story out of Afghanistan about their ability to talk to the Taliban and some movement in that area.
Yeah, there have been rumors for a long time that Afghan officials and even Western officials were talking to Taliban representatives. And it appears now that it has been going on and is intensified, in fact, in recent days and weeks. Afghan President Karzai said that, in fact, they had been speaking to Taliban representatives. And he said also that U.S. and British officials had also been doing the same. And what they really want to do is they want now, it seems, to get the Taliban to set up an office in Turkey so that they could even intensify these talks. And of course, the talks are all aimed at coming to some kind of peace agreement that could hopefully resolve the terrible conflict that's been going on there.
Merhad, on to the next story. Another very interesting story, this time out of Russia, about some movement with the police.
Yeah, we know that this week in Russia, a new law on police came into power, and four activists from Russia's Left Front group were arrested in front of the building of the Interior Ministry this week. The major problem there is that rights activists have expressed concern about a provision in the law banning police officers from discussing their superiors' orders publicly or voicing their opinions in the media. This is what happened last year when several officers, starting with Andrei Dymovsky, made a video addresses to President Dmitry Medvedev saying about the corruption and other office abuses committed by their supervisors. So this is the major issue raised by the...
Well, they're concerned that this law will quash any possible further police officers coming forth to make such allegations.
Yes, this law is considered by them as a way to nix the possible whistleblowers in the police.
But perhaps on a positive note, it seems as if they have included in this law what we know in the West as the Miranda rights, where people who are arrested will be read their rights. Is that correct?
Yes. This is very new for the former Soviet Union in general and for Russia specifically, that every arrested person has a right for at least one phone call, and they have a right to keep mum, to keep silence, and right to have their rights to be given to them and read to them aloud, and also their right to have a lawyer next to them.
Right. And to wrap things up on a bit of a lighter note, the Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi has been in the news, and our local bureaus in Serbia has discovered that a Serbian university says it's not going to revoke an honorary doctorate that it gave to Gaddafi recently. Pete, can you fill us in on that story?
Right, yeah. The dean of Belgrade's Megatrend University has said there's absolutely no reason why they should revoke the PhD that they gave to Gaddafi in 2007. They say they gave the honorary degree based on scientific reasons, and that means he's referring specifically to the Great Man-Made River, which is this huge irrigation project that Gaddafi apparently oversaw in Libya that supplies water to many cities, the capital and also the second city, Benghazi. So it appears that despite all the things he's done in recent weeks and even in years to the people, they see nothing wrong with Gaddafi having a PhD.
Not everybody agrees with that, though, right?
No, that's true. The deputy minister for higher education came out and said, first of all, she kind of slammed the university, saying that considering the quality of this university, she's not at all surprised that they would order or they would give a doctorate to a dictator.
All right, then. Well, thank you very much, Pete Baumgartner, Merhad Sharbjan.
You're welcome.
Until next week, thank you.
You're listening to The Blender, the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
A group of Serbian pro-democracy activists who spearheaded the overthrow of former President Slobodan Milosevic has taken its know-how to the Middle East. The group, called Canvas, has trained activists in Egypt, Tunisia, and elsewhere in the region in nonviolent resistance, with impressive results. Correspondent Courtney Brooks reports.
Sergio Popovich has a dream, a world where political change comes through nonviolent struggle. He started out as a pro-democracy activist in his native Serbia. He founded the group Otpor, or Resistance, which led the protests that drove authoritarian president Slobodan Milosevic from power more than a decade ago. He then helped to train the activists who spearheaded Georgia's Rose Revolution in 2003 and Ukraine's Orange Revolution in 2004. But now Popovich's new organization, Canvas, is exporting democracy even further afield. It's assisting activists who recently brought down despotic regimes in Egypt and Tunisia.
We are simply trying to convince the world that the only right way to make a change is to fight strategically and in a non-violent way. I think that those young secular people that we see these days in the demonstrations all around the Middle East are one new face of that region.
Canvas was founded in 2003 and has trained activists in 37 countries, including Zimbabwe, North Korea, Belarus, and Iran. In the late summer of 2009, Canvas helped bring some 20 Egyptian activists to Belgrade for a week-long training on tactics they could use to promote change in Egypt. The group included some of those who later founded the April 6th movement that spearheaded the recent anti-government protests. Organizers said they talked to the Egyptians about coordinating campaigns, the importance of galvanizing youth support, and how to use social media to reach both of these goals. One of Otpor's main methods in overthrowing Milosevic was to win public support through humor by mocking the regime. They once famously rolled an oil barrel with Milosevic's face on it down a street while people took turns whacking it with a bat. Activists were often arrested and roughed up. But while training dissidents from regimes such as Egypt, Iran, and Belarus, Canvas has had to recognize that it is teaching activists who could spend years in jail for their activities. Nini Gogo Beretse, a Georgian citizen who participated in Georgia's Rose Revolution in 2003, is a Canvas trainer who has worked primarily with Iranian dissidents.
In Georgia and in Ukraine, I doubt that the police and, the security forces or even armed forces would actually initiate a bloodshed in the streets. Whereas I'm pretty sure that's not going to be true in Iran or in any other country where the regime is silent. It's the level of violence that differentiates the struggle from each other. And
she describes the training as brainstorming sessions, where activists use their own creativity in developing methods to fight oppression.
Nobody knows better than the community members how to get mobilized, you know what I mean? That's the whole idea of the nonviolent struggle, because you cannot export 5 or 10 Serbs or Georgians or Ukrainians from their countries and make a revolution in another country. It's totally home-driven and home-grown thing.
She says that none of the Iranians she trained were part of any formal activist organization, such as the Green Movement. She said that she has trained housewives, students, and journalists in how to engage in nonviolent struggle. Asked how Canvas connects with these people, she says simply, they find us.
That was Courtney Brooks reporting. In our Meet the Bloggers segment, we take a few minutes to introduce listeners to the various blogs published on RFERL.org. This week, our Washington bureau chief, Heather Marr, sits down with correspondent Golnaz Esfandiari, who writes our Persian Letters blog.
Welcome, Golnaz. You have a blog called Persian Letters on the RFERL website. Why did you decide to start that blog?
You know, Iran is a nation of bloggers. There are different estimates, but some people say there are about 700,000 blogs in Persian. So we thought that what's missing from the Western coverage of Iran is voices from the people, real people on the ground. You can read about what these people think on their blogs whenever I miss Iran, I was born in Iran, I read blogs and I get a feeling I'm there, you know, with those people. And you also learn a lot about the youth culture, about what's on people's mind, what's important, what's in, what's out, what kind of terms they're using. It's all in the blog. It's very interesting, and it's not black and white. You have other shades. You have gray. It's very interesting. And I think whoever is interested in Iran, in the people of Iran, whoever wants to learn more about the country should read blogs. You have young people blogging. You have clerics blogging. You have people from the government blogging. We recently translated a blog by a member of the Basij force who was writing about how they went out on a day when there was a protest in Tehran and, you know, sort of confront the opposition members who were out in the streets. And the day before, we had an account from a member of the opposition. So we're trying to sort of give a picture of, I mean, bring all these voices translate those blogs and for people who are interested in Iran and who don't speak Farsi. That's basically what we do.
That's so interesting. I don't think many people know that many Iranians are blogging. That's not something that you think of when you think of Iranians.
It's extremely popular. Most young people, when you talk to them, they have their own blog. Which is usually, it's filtered by the government, it's blocked, you know. So some of them, it's very funny. You see them writing on Facebook, oh, today I couldn't open my blog, you know, and then they make fun. They say, oh, it shows that my blog is very important. And someone said on Facebook, you know, that I couldn't open my blog and it had only 10 people visiting per day and 5 of them was me, myself, you know. So, but they're extremely popular. And it's a way, you know, in Iran, you don't have platforms where people can express themselves freely. And these blogs are actually a platform for Iranians, for young people, old people, where they talk about what they think, what they want. And it's not. People wrongly think it's all about politics. It's really not. It's lots of poetry, fashion, sexual relations. You know, you name it, everything is there. And what's very interesting, as I said, the government is also using blogs. Some of the members of the parliament, of the government, they have their own blogs. And there was one case that was very interesting in a way that the Iranian government is using the same tools as other people, is that there's a former member of the government, Mohammad Ali Abtahi, who's a cleric, and he was one of the first person in the government who started blogging, and his blog is extremely popular. He was jailed in 2009 after the disputed re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And he was in jail, and then people noticed that he started blogging from jail. And obviously, it wasn't him. He was, you know, someone else was doing that, and they were saying that he's, you know, he's doing so well in prison, they even let him blog. And people compared his blog posts from the prison, from previous blog posts, and said, look, this is not the language he's been using. But it's very interesting. And as you know, Heather, there have been many bloggers who have been jailed in Iran because of what they've been writing. And we had one case of a blogger who died in prison. And until today, it's not clear how it happened.
Have you seen the number of people who read and follow Persian letters increase in the months that you've been doing it?
Yeah, I get lots of emails from people who say, you know, we know you because of your blog. We enjoy what you're reading. I also get hate mails and people who get angry, like, why did you post a blog post by this Basij guy, you know? Or I get pro-government people who say, like, oh, you're against the Iranian regime. But this is not about it. We're just giving a platform to those voices from inside the country. It's not being against this or against that or pro. It's not. But yeah, I get also lots of fan mails, which is always great, you know, to hear that people enjoy reading the blog and they want more, they're asking for more. For example, students who are interested in Iran or other people, academics. So it's great to see that people read Persian letters.
Golnaz Esfandiari, thank you so much for talking to us today about your blog.
Thank you.
Thanks, Heather and Golnaz. And speaking of bloggers, I wanted to give a shout out to my colleague Brian Whitmore, the author of the Power Vertical blog and a frequent contributor to The Blender. Brian's moved on to hosting his own podcast, The Power Vertical Podcast. Check out the first episode on rferl.org and soon on iTunes.
Podcast every week, consistent content coming at them like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the Blender for this week. Thanks for tuning in, and as always, we'd love to hear from you. Just write to podcast@referl.org. Until next week, this is Grant Podalko saying so long.